Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. Welcome back to the podcast. Thanks for joining us. Today's February 4th and recording this in the deep freeze that Toronto is having. So much snow. Did you see natural gas prices like spike to like $7 and then of course gave it all up? As it looks like it might be a couple weeks of cold, but then it could warm up. So playing natural gas, good luck to you. Don't play commodities in the short term. So January is done. We're talking here in February about the markets. The Greenland stuff, I think, seems to be off the table for now. No one's talking about it. Tariffs seem to be not a discussion at the moment. So that's good. So maybe a little bit of a lull in the uncertainty.
Well, it does seem like the market doesn't take this as seriously anymore, or mm-hmm. the so-called taco trade, where last week, I think there was a threat of placing tariffs specifically on Bombardier planes mm-hmm. in the U.S., but I think Bombardier stock fell like 4%. So it was a relatively small amount compared to what you would have expected.
Very interesting. In the meantime, of course, the U.S. economy numbers seem to be pretty good. We're set up for a bullish year in terms of the economy. Obviously, you can't predict the black swans, the wild cards that happen. But from what we've seen from earnings so far, as Q4 is starting to wrap up, very strong numbers from most of our companies already so far. A lot of our names are reporting double-digit earnings growth and expectation for a good year in 2026. The market, Ernest, has been extremely volatile in the last few days, whether it's commodity prices or worries about the software names, and then the next day worries about semiconductor names. Obviously, it's hard to rationalize and really come up with any reason why stocks have been so volatile, but I would just tell our clients that, you know, given how strong the markets have been over the last 5-10 years, you're coming into this year with valuations at high levels, and there's a lot of expectation that things will deliver good results. And when you have a record markets, the market can be a little more nitpicky, especially if companies don't deliver the results, the great results people are looking for.
Yeah, I think this has really been one of the more, I think, narrative-driven stock markets that I've certainly seen in my life, where last week there was Google announced a demo where you can prompt a playable video game world mm-hmm. and all the video game stocks fell like 10-20%.
Yeah.
And then today's the 4th, so yesterday there was a large sell-off in the whole software space because Claude had released a new legal drafting tool mm-hmm. powered by AI, and for whatever reason that extended to a broad sell-off in anything tangentially related to software.
Software as well as data providers. Yeah. So the market shoots first, asks questions later, figures it out later. If anything, we would use those as opportunities to buy more. So today we're going to talk about the big tech names that released earnings so far. Meta, Microsoft, and Apple, of course, one of our largest positions. And I think we'll also talk a little bit about Brookfield Asset Management, a change there in the CEO. And Ernest has some great commentary and insights on what the company's doing and why we think Brookfield Asset Management is going to hold its own, even if private equity starts to face some tougher comps going forward. Before we get into that, let's get into this. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to us on YouTube, on Apple, and on Spotify. Please leave us a review, comments. We'd love to hear your feedback. We'd love, of course, if you give us the best review you can if you like this podcast. And of course, check out baskinwealth.com. Check out our website and take a look at all the wonderful information we have about becoming a client. If you have any interest or want a second look for your portfolio, we'd love to chat with you. Well, you know, we are very excited about our portfolio as we head into 2026. We have a lot of companies that are reporting strong results, and pretty much we're excited about buying every single stock in our portfolio today. A few names have done incredibly well. Maybe those we'll hold off on, but you know, it's the frustrating thing is when your stocks report good earnings and they don't go up, just means at some point they will. And so we're always happy to continue to buy more stocks when they're going down. It seems counterintuitive, but that's the way you invest, right? If you want to make decent returns in the market, you can't be buying whatever everybody else is buying, what's already worked yesterday. You have to buy what you think is undervalued and it's going to be growing in the future. So that's our approach. Market narratives aside, we're here to focus on long-term investing. I would be remiss if I didn't remind our clients and those who follow us how we think about markets and volatility. When narrative's coming at you and there's everybody telling you you're dumb for holding a certain company or a certain sector, or the stock goes down a number of days in a row and
whatever
it is, with really no specific news, vibes, headlines. We've been through this before so many times. I remember years ago when Amazon said it was getting into all these different verticals, whether it's groceries or auto parts. I think we referenced that last time. Our pharmaceuticals, the stocks that the stocks in those sectors just went down a lot. And then people figured out that maybe Amazon won't take very much market share. It's very hard to disrupt incumbents. It's very hard to disrupt, habitual behaviors and buying and working with, your providers and things things that you're used to going to the stores and relationships. And so just because someone has built a better mousetrap doesn't necessarily mean that the customers are going to switch. You can tell that to Apple users, right? Who may not have the best technology in their phones, never innovating, but certainly seems to be the market leader in phones. So the narrative on Apple, Ernest, well, let's get into that. We all remember a couple years ago, and everybody was so articulate to us stating the bear case on Apple. Not growing in China. In fact, it's losing market share in China. Warren Buffett, he's trimming Apple, shouldn't we? Not innovative anymore. Look, they just keep coming out with the same iterations of the iPhones. AI, they're not spending any money on AI, and their Siri product is not even ready for prime time, and who knows if it's ever going to happen. A lot of...
regulatory?
Yeah, I was going to get to that. Regulatory, yeah. So all these narratives... Of course, stock's going to be under pressure because these sound legit and scary. And there's a ring of truth to...
Right.
There's a ring of truth to generally every narrative.
Yes.
But that doesn't mean that it's material to the stock. That doesn't mean that it's not already priced in. That doesn't mean that there's other levers and drivers that great businesses can use to adapt. And so, Ernest, I'll kick it over to you. Let's talk about Apple. And the stock is rocking and rolling. It's pretty much near an all-time high. All those bear cases have fallen away. Maybe there's still some truth to some of them, but what matters is the results, and the results are stunning. I remember people saying Apple's never going to grow again. Here's Apple, I think, had double-digit revenue growth and guiding for double-digit revenue growth for the next quarter, and saying we're coming out with a whole new bunch of products and services. Stay tuned.
No, I think for iPhone specifically, it was a record quarter for Apple, and this is for the Christmas season, so the December quarter, where they usually launch the products in September, October, and then so the bulk of the sales happen from the December quarter for Apple. It was
as well as going into the new year, right?
Yep.
So they'll sell a lot of new iPhones. Last quarter and the first quarter of 26.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so it was a record quarter for iPhone sales. Now, I think some of this was because just kind of natural replacement cycle of the iPhones that came from the phones that were purchased in 2020.
Everybody was
2020
waiting
to 2021.
This. Yeah, everybody was waiting for this, the cycle of people upgrading their phones. I think Apple kind of pushed it by launching all this new iOS software, which really makes your phone impossible to use if you have older versions, and eventually promising some kind of AI features. Yep. So you have to upgrade. And clearly people aren't swapping to Huawei or Google phones, right?
No, and so that's what we saw, where I think part of the strong revenue growth was partly because they had a price increase. So
Apple has pricing power? The market totally forgot that?
Yeah, the 17 versus the 16, like for like, I think was about a 10% price increase. Mm-hmm. They specifically called out the upgraders, so people who previously had the base version upgrading to the Pro version or the Pro Max version. So that was another contributor to the strong results. And I think that's really because people want like a nicer camera or more performance within the phone. And then lastly was China, which is it's been a more volatile market for them, certainly, because I think the ecosystem effect is a little weaker for Apple in China versus the rest of the
world. But what the heck did Apple do in China so differently that sales were up 30% versus being down 10 or 15% a year ago?
Well, I think there's a few things. Number one is that there was a government subsidy program where phones under a certain price threshold were eligible for the subsidy, mm-hmm. and Apple had cut the price of its phones to make them eligible for the subsidy. So that's number one. And then number two is that, you know, I think from time to time, people in China respond to new, larger refreshes of iPhone models, and the iPhone 17 just happened to be one of those. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly encouraging, given...
We also had a very strong iPad upgrade cycle, yep. and Apple said they were limited by the amount of AirPods that they produced.
Yes.
There's huge demand for the new AirPods, and it's just going to take time for them to create the inventory.
Yeah, so I think the kind of the big question for the earnings call was what's going to happen to... Like, how does high memory prices, because that's currently the hot topic, how does that impact your business?
That's right. So what do people need to know about high memory prices? Why are prices for a commodity, it's just memory, right? Everybody knows that, you know, there's no one has any better memory than anybody else. It's just the same stuff.
Yep.
But why is the demand off the charts and pricing for memory going straight up?
Well, it's just because memory... It's just supply and demand, where there's a supply of manufacturing capacity from the main memory suppliers, being like Seagate, Western Digital, and those kinds of companies. Mm-hmm. They made X memory. Now demand went up because of the demand in AI.
Yeah.
And as a result, price went up. I think Samsung was raising prices for memory for up to 100%, right? Mm. And so I think that was kind of the natural question for Apple is how is this going to impact you? And furthermore, because of all the demand for AI-related chip production at TSMC, Apple itself is facing supply constraints in manufacturing its leading-edge chips for the iPhone. Mm-hmm. And so those were kind of the big questions for Apple in the earnings call. Mm-hmm. I think with regards to the memory piece, they kind of didn't really answer how they would manage it. But I think what you need to know about Apple is that Apple usually has long-term memory supply contracts with most of these providers. They're such a large buyer of memory that they have contracted supply in place. But I think more importantly is that Apple charges a massive premium for memory mm-hmm. when you buy an iPhone. Mm-hmm. I think
everybody knows when you buy an iPhone, you can get 125 gigs of memory, 250 gigs of memory, or 1 terabyte, right? I think, and they make a ton of money reselling that memory to you.
They earn massive margins on this because right now I think memory costs like $7.
Okay.
I think if you're upgrading your device on the Apple checkout screen, I think you're paying like $200. Mm-hmm. So they're earning a massive amount reselling. So even if there's a large spike in memory prices, they're very easily just going to able to absorb.
Well, the expectation is they'll pass it on some of it to the consumer, maybe eat some of it,
right?
And hopeful that nothing cures high prices like high prices,
right?
And the demand for memory will lead to more memory being built,
yeah.
And we'll have an oversupply at some point, and price of memory will plummet.
Yeah, I do think that these are more kind of nearer term questions, because sometimes...
But they're not as fundamental as...
No.
Apple's losing in China. Apple's losing in AI. Buffett doesn't like it anymore. It's not innovative. There's no revenue growth. These are not bearish
right.
cases.
No. Yeah. So that's exactly what I was going to say, which is that I think there's two types of questions that investors need to answer. Mm-hmm. There's kind of longer term what happens to the company questions, and I think you need a view on that if you want to own the stock.
100%.
But then there's these shorter term kind of what I would call management questions, where it's the job of Apple's management to figure these things out, ensure that, you know, manage the pricing of their products to capture higher memory prices, ensure that they're having adequate chip supply for their iPhones.
Mm-hmm.
And these are not really things that are kind of too important for investors to worry about, especially if you're planning to own the stock for 5 or 10 years.
And if you're worried about overspending and overbuild of AI and this nonstop CapEx from Microsoft and Google and Amazon and Meta, well, hello, with Apple, it's letting other people spend the money and just printing cash right now, right?
No, it is interesting, because on the one hand, you have such fear in the markets about how AI is going to disrupt everything from video games to software to data providers and so on. Mm-hmm. But the market is similarly skeptical about the returns that hyperscalers are going to earn on right. spending on AI infrastructure.
So that's a great segue to talk about Microsoft and Meta, who both surprised the markets with much higher capital expenditures than maybe what was modeled for, although not really that much of a surprise, yeah. given that these companies have talked for years now that they're going to be spending a lot and lot on data centers and AI chips, and because the demand is there. Microsoft, of course, resells the compute power to others, kind of like letting moving goods like a railroad, whereas Meta uses all the compute power pretty much for its own internal purposes.
Exactly.
So you have two different companies, both saying that we're earning good returns on AI and we need to up the spending, because if we don't, someone else will, and we're at risk of maybe being disrupted.
No, so for Microsoft, I think the stock had a pretty sharp downward reaction.
Tell me about it. We call that a barfy reaction, but yeah.
But the headline results were actually pretty good. The core, like the 365 business, they continue to sell more Copilot subscriptions to subscribers, and they're still adding a lot of seats.
Everything I saw was double digit up, right? Most of the business divisions, and everything I saw is after the analysts spoke to Microsoft and had the conference call, everybody was raising their earnings estimates. Yet, of course, because the stock was so wonky, we have to come up with something, must be toxic in there. And so here you go. The stock has fallen about 20%. Even though the results are as good as we expected and should be even better going forward. So, this is the one where the market gives you opportunities and you better not sit on your hands watching it.
Yeah, so the issue specifically was that the Azure hyperscale business, so the external cloud business, had a slightly worse revenue result than what the market was expecting. Yeah. And by slightly, I mean like, they did 39 when the market was 39% growth versus 40% growth.
That's right. So, for anybody who understands math, I think growing 39% or 40%, both pretty phenomenal.
Was it 29? Oh, no, it's 29 and 30. Yeah.
No, 39.
No, 39, 30, yes.
I think they did 38 or 30, whatever
yeah.
it was.
Yeah.
And of course, they met expectations from analysts. It's just people are saying, well, there was a whisper number. So people yeah. are looking for more. And Microsoft said, hey, we could have done a lot more, but the growth of AI for our internal
right.
Products like Copilot or what have you is so strong that we needed to direct some compute power to run our own business.
Right. And that was exactly the reason that Microsoft did that is because they earn higher margins when mm-hmm. they are selling compute to themselves for 365 subscribers and dynamic subscribers, as opposed to reselling it to third parties.
So we'll let the market figure out why the stock is down. This is going to happen all the time when companies report earnings. Maybe it may not be enough. I talked about it a few minutes ago. Maybe just record markets, record expectations. Mm-hmm. But we'll follow the fundamentals, and they seem pretty strong. Is anything changing with the returns on AI? Are they seeing better returns? Are they feeling more bullish about spending on AI? Clearly.
No, so I think that was kind of what I was most interested in going into this earnings cycle, which is, number one, are the companies seeing revenues from all this money that they're spending on AI, mm-hmm. which so far clearly everybody is. And number two, are the margins going to be there? Because that's what is going to dictate the return on invested capital that they're seeing. I think Microsoft reported that the margins are going to be stable this year. Mm-hmm. So I think clearly they expect good returns that they're getting from the CapEx that they're spending. And more importantly, mm-hmm. it's all contracted. So there's no risk that, say, the demand doesn't materialize for what they're spending.
It seems so unlikely. Now, of course, did any of these companies give an indication at what point capital expenditures will start to peak? Or is that far away in the future?
They haven't said that yet. Yeah. I think everybody is still currently capacity constrained. Mm-hmm. I think we saw NVIDIA invest $20 billion in OpenAI just to give them more money for computing.
Of course, everybody's capacity constrained. There's new AI stuff every single day. And, you know, there's billions of people on this planet that still haven't even looked at AI, let alone billions of people on this planet that haven't even transformed their operating businesses to running software. The opportunities are massive. We're very North American centric here, yeah. but think about other countries where Microsoft and Apple have the ability to sell products and services where they're still developing. The white space is quite huge. Meta, this is the one where the AI is really, really showing strong results, but it's being hidden by the fact that Meta's just spending like a drunken sailor on this compute power. If Meta isn't reselling it, why does it need to spend $135 billion on AI CapEx in 2026? What is it trying to achieve here?
So for some context, the $136 billion is 100% of their operating cash flow.
Yeah.
So they're spending everything that they make basically on additional server capacity mm-hmm. to train AI in the pursuit of what they call AI superintelligence.
Okay.
And so I think there's been some skepticism about what exactly they're spending on. I think it's useful to think about Meta and what Zuckerberg has been doing with Meta throughout its entire corporate history, is that if you look at a social media website, right, by itself, so you can say Reddit or MySpace back in the day.
Threads, Blue Sky, yeah.
These are just simply not awesome businesses where, yeah, there's some network effects and you might be able to sell some ads into it, but there's not really very much that protects the business from disruption going forward.
Mm-hmm. Nor are your customers captured. They can go to another platform, as we saw with TikTok out of nowhere becoming huge.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think Zuckerberg really understands this, and throughout Facebook and Meta's history has really tried to, all of the things that he's been criticized for doing in the past has been an attempt to, you know, defend Meta and Facebook to create it as a more resilient company going forward. So when they acquired WhatsApp for, I think it was $26 billion, it was kind of scoffed at. When they acquired Instagram, when they spent on Reality Labs, it was not just a vanity project that Zuckerberg thought VR is cool. It was an attempt to control the platform given how Apple was squeezing Facebook mm-hmm. and their ability to target ads. And now I think this investment in AI is the same thing, where he can see the future where it's possible that one day people are engaging with, you know, an AI app, and that is able to displace what Facebook or Instagram is currently doing. Mm-hmm. And so for Facebook or for Meta, I think what all this CapEx is going to is to try and protect the business from what could happen down the line.
That's right. And because it makes so much money, it can spend that kind of money on and not really blow up its balance sheet. Sure, we would like Meta to gush more cash and maybe buy back stock or raise its dividend. But as you said, it views this as an existential opportunity. And if it wants to achieve whatever we think super intelligence is,
yes,
you can't spend $2 on it.
No, and exactly. Yeah. That's to your point. They are seeing returns on it. So mm-hmm. it's not totally money that's going into the toilet. Mm-hmm. They're really able to use a lot of this capacity to improve ad targeting, to generate videos for users, and those kinds of things as well.
Okay, so we'll have more big tech to discuss in the coming weeks. We'll certainly want to cover Amazon and Google and what they're saying. Still remain big parts of our portfolio. We want to finish off just talking about the CEO change at Brookfield Asset Management. Bruce Flatt is still the CEO of the parent company, Brookfield
Corporation.
At some point, he may step down, but he's still a youngish guy. He's got more gas in the tank. But this was well-telegraphed, well-announced. Connor Teskey is going to be running Brookfield Asset Management. He's been there since,
2012, yes.
2012, worked in a lot of different divisions. Brookfield Asset Management just reported earnings today, raises dividend 15%. This company is doing exactly what it said it was going to do when they decided to split the company from Brookfield Corporation. They said, we're going to raise the dividend 15% a year. We're going to have record fundraising. We're going to launch a bunch of new funds. We're going to get into insurance. And so far, the results have been very, very good. The stock has pulled back, as has a lot of what we'll call alternative asset managers. We'll get into this maybe in another podcast, but there has been concerns about the performance of private equity, private credit, private debt, as well as a lot of other alternative investment assets. And as a result, it's taking those stocks down with it. But we have a different take on why Brookfield should thrive and survive in this environment.
So I think the long story is that Brookfield doesn't really play in most of the spaces that are currently under distress. Mm-hmm. What is, I think people are worried about today is private credit, especially those that are funding kind of mediocre assets, whether it be, in Canada, funding like subprime mortgages and construction loans and those kinds of things, or in the US, whether it be funding large software leverage buyouts, right?
Yes. Whereas, and with the price of software stocks collapsing, leverage buyout of a software stock where you eventually want to take it public again,
right?
Doesn't look so good now.
And so historically, Brookfield mm-hmm. Asset Management, so the asset management business, they've more focused on infrastructure type stuff. So, things like utilities, like ports, mm-hmm. like telecom infrastructure, and now increasingly data centers. Like, these are more, not really the sexiest growth things to buy, but they kind of provide stable, recurring GDP-like growth. And so they're a little bit more protected from some of the volatility in the market. And even on the private credit side, their credit business today is largely made up of what used to be Oaktree, which is more of an asset-backed lender mm-hmm. and an opportunistic lender, as opposed to large LBO lender.
So Brookfield tends to invest more in the tangible world,
yes,
versus the intangibles of lending companies money to be taken over for right. a buyout, or taking advantage of arbitrage by building up a private equity business and then just reselling it to another higher bidder. That's not how Brookfield operates for the most part.
No, and I think you see that in the results, where they had a record quarter and year of mm-hmm. fundraising. I think they raised $100 billion or something like
That's crazy.
$116 billion.
Yeah.
And 2026 is going to be another good year. Institutional investors are still giving them more money for mm-hmm. whether it for their AI infrastructure fund or whatever, and there's not really any of the issues that are popping up for the other managers happening for Brookfield, at least on a large scale.
See you soon. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.